Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Boy. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. With me today to go over our top 10 films of 2017, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello, it's now officially 2018 now that we're doing a top 10 list.
Yeah, I've been purposefully writing 2017 on all my checks and then the bank calls, and I am like, guess what, motherfucker? We haven't done a top 10 episode yet. It's still happening. We also have Bill Graham.
Woo!
Yeah. Oh, man, top 10 time. It's that time of year a month ago. But here we are. As always, it takes us a little longer because there's still some stuff we want to see. In fact, I was down to record this on, like, Monday of last week. And Michael Snydell just said, no, man, there's still a couple movies I gotta see. So if one of those didn't make your top 10, I'm going to be deeply upset with you.
Oh, boy.
Just laying it all on the line. If I hear stuff that I know has been out for a while. Oh, man. All right. So since that's all we're doing, no real preamble necessary, aside from the usual stuff, patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. It's a great way for you to support us and everything that we do here. All you gotta do is go there, pledge as little as $1 an episode. You get access to our Slack channel, you get entered into a bunch of cool raffles, and you get to force us to make more episodes. We're already doing classic reviews. This month we'll be doing Paris, Texas at some point. And, yeah, there's other stuff that we'll be doing. So go over to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow to see what you could force us to do. And to sign up to give us a little bit of scratch, a little bit of dough, throw some ducats our way. Also, you can find us on Twitter @FilmStageShow, Facebook The Film Stage Show, email us podcast@thefilmstage.com, and as always, rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. And another way to support us while also giving yourself something cool that costs you nothing is to go to Mubi.com/filmstage and sign up for your free 30-day trial of Mubi. Mubi introduces a new film every day, and you have 30 days to watch, so you have a constantly rotating selection of 30 films. Around the same time that this episode drops, you will also get my interview with Jordan and Dan Mecca, who went to the Sundance Film Festival. You'll get to hear some of the stuff that they saw, which they enjoyed, and in the spirit of the Sundance Film Festival, Mubi is releasing, over the next couple of days, a bunch of films that premiered at Sundance. So, for instance, Ain't Them Bodies Saints and Room 237 are just two of the wonderful selections that they got coming. And, of course, Lover for a Day is in theaters now. Go to loverforaday.mubi.com to see where that is playing near you. So, again, for your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage. All right, so... anything before we get into our top tens? Any news? Any fun stuff?
Well, should, in the spirit of it being top 10, is there anything that you guys, before we even get into honorable mention, anything that you guys wish that you got to but you were not able to get to?
I made a lot of attempts to see the movie Novitiate.
Okay.
And none of them were successful. And that movie has like a bunch of stuff that seemed like they would be right up my alley. So I feel like that could have been one of those random ones that I see that no one else loves enough to put on their top 10, but that I definitely do. I'm also a little upset that I haven't been able to see Mudbound yet, even though it is on Netflix and I could watch it any of the many times that I'm simply vegging out on my couch, mainlining Mad Men. But you know, I think that that's part of the problem with the whole Netflix release thing is that like first of all, I haven't ever seen Mudbound on my screen. Like, and so if I were to turn it on, I'd be like, all right, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to, baby's in bed. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to watch Mudbound. And then suddenly there's Don Draper leering at me. And I'm just like, you know what, Don, you got me again.
I have to say a thing about Mudbound too. I guess we never talked about Mudbound on here. It's not on my top 10, but I have a lot of affection for it. I wrote a little bit about it for a actor capsule. But what I actually wanted to say about it, which was really weird, is one time we actually tried to watch it during the day. And the first scene is Rachel Morrison's cinematography is so dark and deliberately muddy to like convey a point that it was so difficult to watch the beginning that we had to wait until we were able to watch it at night sometime.
See, that's it hurts my heart that Mudbound got nominated for cinematography and yet it was nearly impossible to see in a movie theater.
Sure. Unless you went to, well, I guess Sundance is where I believe it played.
I believe so. So that was a little weird. But I guess those are my two. I really wish I'd gotten to. Everything else I feel like I was able to get out there and see. What about you, Bill?
There's quite a few things. A lot of things on kind of the fringes. Certainly stuff in the documentary category. I really wish I had gotten around to seeing Faceless Places and a lot of other things. There's a couple of other like foreign language films that I really wish I had gotten around to. I think one of them is Loveless, and there's some others. You know, it's one of those things where I'm in the fortunate situation where I get a lot of screeners for Oscar season, not because I'm an Oscar voter, but because that's just the award season kind of terminology. And I was in the process of moving, and so I got like half of the screeners I should have gotten this year, which really put a damper on like me, because I don't know, I guess I was just a lazy asshole, and once those screeners didn't arrive, I was like, well, fuck, okay, I guess I'm not gonna see that. So that's how that situation went.
But so, like, other than those ones you mentioned, like, nothing really that kind of popped out?
I wanted to see Darkest Hour. I wanted to see, what else didn't I catch? I mean, there's a lot of little things here and there. I should have seen I, Tonya by now, but, it is what it is. I still have the opportunity.
I really want to see Darkest Hour and I, Tonya, but I mainly for the performances, and I don't know that they would be movies that would crack my top 10. I will say this, also kind of in the vein of what we're doing here. My top 12 is like one of the strongest top 12s that I've ever seen, but like immediately after that, everything kind of falls off into just being like it, none of it was a threat. Like, I have kind of agonized over it today, because I'm like, man, is there any way that I can like buddy up some of these so that 11 and 12 can somehow both be in everything?
A three-way tie or something.
Yeah. Or like, you know, okay, well, my number 10 is two like sequels to movies that are over 20 years old. And like, you know, my number 9 is two movies that are about, you know, oppressed minorities and viewing it through a different lens. And, you know, but I just couldn't do it. So unfortunately, someone's got to lose. And, you know, it's sad. It's really sad, actually. I would say that my 9 and 10 spot were kind of up in play between 11 and 12. But like, again, after that, it's not like, oh man, my top 25 is the best. It's like, no, really, once you move past 12, your mileage is going to vary a lot. And I'm on my Letterboxd. I apparently saw... Now it's telling me I've got to load it, and I haven't put the Phantom Thread on, but I've seen like 50 new films last year, and I would say that around 31 to 32 is where it just got like bad. Like, those are the movies I did not enjoy, and that is not a great hit to miss ratio. So I don't know, like, did you guys feel like this year was particularly good or bad?
I didn't like this year very much, but I kind of attribute a lot of that to my own mental state of being, to be honest.
That makes sense.
I watched a lot less films than I did last year. Like 2016, I watched almost 185 films. This last year, I watched 120. That was a huge... I just watched a lot less movies last year for a variety of reasons, and I just my top 10 is something I like, but weirdly this feels a lot like a personally like a transition year for me. Like, I found out a lot of things that I like about film and what I look for, but I don't know how many of these I'm gonna be still be thinking about, you know, 5-10 years from now. Not that that's, you know, the way to say whether something's good or not.
Yeah. I will say that a lot of these, I kind of went on an accidental, like, run of rewatching my top 10 just because I got the Blu-rays for Christmas and then just started watching them all. And, like, my wife hadn't seen some. So I was like, well, guess what we're doing? And so some of these are going to sound crazy, but having rewatched them, yeah, I really honestly do feel like they were in the top 10 of the year.
Well, I just got done watching Get Out for the second time. So
that was,
you know,
one of them. Yeah,
a girlfriend hadn't seen it yet. And I was like, let's do this. So, yeah.
All right.
I rewatched Coco the other night. Coco's a pretty good movie.
Oh, Jesus.
Coco is a great movie. That is, I'll just say, it didn't make my top 10. Which is sad, because I feel like for a little while it could have, but it's in that, I think it's on my Letterboxd, it is number 16.
Oh, really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The second time, the level of detail in this movie, and just being able to watch it without thinking too much about, you know, following the weirdly twisting plot for a Pixar film, but
yeah.
there's so much detail in that movie that's just so rewarding to, like, just glance at the screen
and see
such a wide variety of, like, cultural references and character detail.
I think I remember talking about it where I said, like, all I ever saw the trailer on was, like, my phone or a computer. And so I was like, I was really underwhelmed, but then actually seeing it in the theater, I was like, oh shit, this is why our movie screens are so big, because of this kind of thing. Cause, like, something that was the size of a pixel is suddenly the size of a small dog. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool, awesome. That's great.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I remember a couple of years ago when Mad Max Fury Road came out, there's a lot of, you know, that film is very splashy and that film is very kind of bombastic, but there's a lot of, like, little small details and things that you, if you watch it on, like, a big screen TV, you just won't get that same feeling, because I watched it when it came back in theaters in black and white, and I watched it again when it did a couple of additional runs at the theaters, and I was just like, this is just a completely different experience, because you can see all these, like, little things, like you were mentioning, Brian, like there's just little stuff that you can pick up on, and like, oh, look, there's that little thing and there's this thing, and it's like, well,
especially for
wow.
like Mad Max Fury Road, like, it's the scale, like, on your phone or a TV, like, you know, it's kind of impressive, but then when you see it in a movie theater, you're like, oh yeah, those are cars with real people in them.
Well,
that's
the big thing. Yeah. Yeah. You can definitely see, like, holy shit, that is an actual vehicle smashing into another vehicle. Like, this is real. So
it's pretty great. All right. Well,
I was just going to say that the weird other thing in relation to Fury Road is that, like, the big thing that people were also saying was to see it in 3D. And the difference, I saw it for the first time at a press screening in 3D. And then seeing it just in regular DCP, it was like, wait, this is the type of color that was here? It's this it's this strange experience where I at once, like, obviously seeing it on a huge screen, you can also point to Dunkirk with this, is a completely different experience. But then you think about 3D, which is supposed to be the most immersive experience, and you're still losing so much of the actual filmmaking process.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't know how we got on Mad Max theaters and everything, but let's do it. So we're going to do top 10s. round robin style, starting at 10, going down. So let's start off with Bill Graham.
Sure.
I would also like to remind you, gentlemen, to keep your synopses and reactions brief.
Sure. Are we going to focus more on kind of having a conversation about each one of ours, or are we just going to talk about it briefly and then move on?
Just like, you know, you say what it is, and then you say why you liked it that much, and then if someone's got something to say to you, they can say it. But if not, we can move on.
To my face.
Yeah, exactly. I would love it if this became really combative and people just started being like, no, that is fucked up. Take it off your list.
My number 10 of the year is Logan. I have a very strong love for Hugh Jackman in this particular role of Wolverine. It really did for me kickstart the new revolution of having superhero films, and we can debate whether that's a good thing or not. I think it's inevitable that even if superhero films hadn't come around, something else would have taken its place, and we would all equally kind of have give it side eye. So this film kind of wraps up his role as Wolverine, and I think it does it in a very elegant, very beautiful, very violent way. I think it's no surprise that this one is the only one of those films that is rated R, and I can't remark how much enjoyment I get out of having him in that role for this long. And I feel like it's a great swan song for him as a character, and just the whole kind of X-Men saga that it kickstarted.
Yeah, I gotta say that's a really great movie. I enjoyed it a lot when we saw it, and it's in my top 20. I think that, you know, it's one of those movies that, like, I enjoyed a hell of a lot. I'd love to watch it again, but it didn't, for me, reach the heights of something that would get in my top 10. That being said, nominated for an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Yeah. That's a hell of a thing. A hell of a thing.
And I got to agree, the rated R, it helps. It helps a lot, especially with the kind of story they were telling and how it kind of comments on the previous movies and almost, like, calls them fake, which is great.
Yeah.
No, that's a solid choice. All right.
Cool.
Michael Snydell, number 10.
My number 10 is S. Craig Zahler's Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Fuck yeah.
And so I've still been trying to figure out what makes S. Craig Zahler then kind of different from the kind of return of, you know, directors who were obsessed with grindhouse and exploitation films. And I mean, interestingly enough, S. Craig Zahler kind of pushes back on being called an exploitation filmmaker. But I think that in a way, his love for the genre is usually a yellow or a red flag for me. Because as much as someone like, you know, people who appeal to fanboys, whether it's Quentin Tarantino, who I do generally like, but then even, you know, somewhat a little bit more left field, like Joe Lynch, or someone who is very much making homages to the films that he loved growing up. I think S. Craig Zahler, what he gets about his genre films and pulp films is that the violence can't just be violence for the sake of violence. And so this is his follow-up to Bone Tomahawk, which as well was a very unusual Western, one with kind of an intoxicating rhythm, and one whose violence came nearly at the end, but served a really powerful thematic purpose. And I think Brawl in Cell Block 99 as well is a, you know, at times it feels it's a simple revenge film, but it's one with such a sense of purity and emotional realism, strange as that is, that it just becomes a descent into hell that is both incredibly entertaining and feels incredibly entertaining and feels deeply resonating without feeling gratuitous or without feeling self-conscious. And I honestly think this is Vince Vaughn's career best performance.
Agreed. That's all I'm going to say for now. Because I'm being paid. But that will all be, I'll just say it's going to show up in my list.
Okay. I like the film. I didn't find it anything more than that. I think Bone Tomahawk is a far better film in a lot of different ways. Yeah, that's it. It's good. It's good.
All right.
So my response would sorry, I just want to say briefly.
Oh,
I think
my God,
the
we already had a podcast on it.
No, I know, but I think this is more focused. I think that's why I think it's a overall better film. I think it commits and doesn't get lost in some of Zoller's indulgences the way I think Bone Tomahawk does just a bit.
All right, my number 10.
I'm done, Brian, I promise.
I'm making a game time decision. I'm swapping out 11 and 10.
Uh-oh. Whoa.
Oh.
you'll hear what my original 10 was previously. But no, I'm going to say my number 10 is Princess Sid. A movie that we watched and we talked briefly with the director of. We never did a full review, but it's kind of funny. It's funny what's getting swapped out. I'll just say it. Initially, my number 10 was Blade Runner 2049.
Oh, you son of a bitch.
I know. And I've been struggling with it because I'm like, I love Blade Runner 2049. I think it's really great and it's, you know, beautiful. It was nominated for production design and cinematography for the Academy Awards. But I think that, like, the more I think back over my top 10 and kind of what I've been awarding, if me happening to give a number to a film can be said to be a reward, is interesting looks into, like, interesting lives and thoughtful commentary on whatever you're happening to go for. And I think that Princess Sid, its log line actually made me, like, kind of roll my eyes. I wasn't sure that I would like it, but, like, it subverted every expectation I had and became exactly the type of movie that I love, and that the way that it loves its characters and allows them to have their flaws and allows them to speak to each other like humans, and the way that it makes that cinematically compelling and everything else about it is just, like, beautiful and flawless. And I remember when it was over, just, like, feeling as though, like, some level of cynicism or darkness had been excised from me and I felt lighter afterwards. And just, like, so happy that someone who has a thought process and a concept of humanity and morality like me is out there making work like that. It just made me feel a little less alone in the world, in both a sense of humanity, but also a sense of, like, my kind of views and concepts and ideas being represented artistically. And that was good. And so, like, staring at my list, I was like, I don't want to not talk about this movie. So Blade Runner 2049 got shafted to 11 and Princess Sid rose to number 10.
Nice.
All right. any feedback for me from that?
I think we'll see it again.
Oh,
maybe. I think we'll see it again as well.
Oh shit. All right. Well, let's do number 9. Bill Graham.
My number 9 is the one that you just kicked out. It's Blade Runner 2049, which rightfully belongs on my list. Look, we've done a lot of podcasts on the films that I'm going to list, unfortunately. That being said, I just can't state how much I enjoyed having that experience in a theater. It's one of those films that
I just want to say, Bill, it's crazy because this movie is 43 minutes longer than you usually like a movie to be.
I know. And I said it on the podcast and I'll reiterate it again. I could have dealt with longer. I could have handled more. The film is fucking beautiful. It just really, really is. And that's not my only watermark for a film. But for this film in particular, it had to hit that note and it sung it. It absolutely sung it. I adore Gosling's performance in it, and I think this film is so fucking audacious for having a main character. If you haven't seen this fucking movie, I'm sorry, I hate you. You need to go see this movie, because this movie made absolutely fuck all at the theaters. It gives us a main character who thinks he's the main character of the story and then rips that rug out from under him. And I can't remember another film that is this mainstream that does it like that. Mm-hmm. It's pretty damn interesting that the studio even allowed that to happen. There's a lot of money that's probably being lost on this film. Ultimately, it may actually sink a production company, but damn, is it a great film.
That is and a perfect it's got a lot for that production company.
Yeah,
like you can go down in flames with honor, sir.
Oh yeah. It's got a hell of a storyline. It's got a lot of things on its mind. I think it actually one-ups Her in a lot of ways in 5 minutes. It's just a ballsy movie from beginning to end, and I couldn't adore it more. So
yeah, I'll second pretty much everything you said. Like, it was going to be my number 10. So obviously yeah. I loved it. Smart sci-fi, moody noir, melded together in a beautiful marriage of pretty images and good writing and great acting. Yeah. Plus, it's my boy Denis V.
Yeah, Denis V.
Who I think this is the first film that he directed that didn't make my top 10. I'm pretty sure Enemy, Sicario, and Arrival all placed pretty high. I don't know. I guess it's just been a strong year.
Prisoners.
That was the same year as Enemy came out?
I think it was, yeah. It was a weird time for that film, yeah, I think.
But Enemy came out after Prisoners, even though I think it was filmed before. But I know that, like, since Enemy, everything he's done has made my top 10. Blade Runner 2049, gotcha. Being a bit bigger, I think, like I said, that it sunk it a little bit for me, because I, going over things, realized that everything that I was awarding was pretty small. In its own way.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Snydell, gotcha. Number 9.
My number 9 is a film we haven't talked about on here. You guys might have heard of it. I think it actually ended up on our pretty high on our larger top 50 on the Film Stage website.
And Twin Peaks: The Return?
No. Twin Peaks: The Return is great, though, but I have no opinion about whether it's film or television. Anyway, the film is Bill Morrison's Dawson City: Frozen Time. And so this is a kind of stranger than fiction story, an extremely fascinating story about how almost 600 silent film reels were found under the snow in the Yukon, in what was a subarctic swimming pool in a building. And so the film is at once a kind of show reel for many of those silent reels, but it's also doubles as a history of a film, and a history of film as it relates to how the Yukon became the odd locus of nearly everything that matters within the history of cinema. And so I have to say, at first watching this, I almost wanted it to only be a collage of the silent films, because the silent films have kind of been warped. Not kind of been warped. All of them have been warped. So even huge parts of the frame have, you know, these blotted warped spaces, and it gives everything just this magical ethereal quality. But constructed as both a collage and this larger documentary as an of archival photography, and combined with Alex Summers' score, which is one of the best scores of the year, I think it's truly a great experience, and it's a little bit unwieldy. And not quite as a film, not quite as easy to watch as some of his other thing, or excuse me, as some of his other work. The only other full length feature I've seen from him is Miner's Hymn. And I do partly wish it was only a collage of the still photography, but I think it's a fascinating film, and I think that it achieves something very surprising and ultimately really powerful.
I have not seen this film. I have nothing to add. Bill,
yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, that's one of those that I wanted to see. Yeah, but I never got around to it.
Yeah. All right, so me, number 9. Oh, yes. My number 9, which if I had kept my number 10 in place, would have been a good little diptych up there, is another film that is a sequel to a movie that seemed to require no sequel and was decades old. It is T2, Trainspotting. And I don't know how, like, I think that this is one of those moments that kind of proves to me that, like, some people don't like a movie for the right reasons is the best way to put it. Because I think if you're the type of person who really loved Trainspotting and you have grown up the way that a person is supposed to over the course of, you know, 15, 20 years, you should adore T2. Like, you should recognize the genius that went into creating this sequel, because it is a sequel in the best possible way that a sequel can be. It's not the continuing adventures of Renton, Sick Boy, and Spud and Begbie. It is like an honest to God, like, dipping back into their lives to see how they're doing. And I think the movie is very honest in the ways that many of them are not doing well at all. And as far as a trip down, like, nostalgia lane, it's an interesting play. It also comments on that greatly. And I think that it's just Danny Boyle feeling a little more, like, playful and alive than he has in a long time. And it's just so interesting to see these people bring back these characters and inhabit them so fully and so, in some cases, mirthlessly, just understanding the crushing reality and the passage of time. Like, this isn't Han Solo re-entering the Millennium Falcon and smiling while still wearing his vest and, like, trying to appear as though he's still the man he was 30 years ago. Like, when we meet Spud, he looks like a person who has been on heroin for 20 years. When we first meet Sick Boy, he is exactly the type of vaguely okay failure that you would expect from him. And Begbie's in fucking prison.
Isn't he taking webcam footage?
He is
of people having sex and then blackmailing them about it.
Exactly. He is he's using his girlfriend to blackmail married men when they go to meet her for sex. So that's a thing.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's exactly the type of shit that Simon would pull. And it's weird how, like, okay this movie is with being utterly depressing, and even taking the kind of happy ending of the last film, you know, Trainspotting, like, Renton comes back, he's talking to Spud, and he's like, I don't understand why you're so angry. I gave you, you know, the 4,000 pounds that I owed you. And Spud is like, yeah, I was a junkie. Like, what did you think I was going to do with 4,000 pounds? And there's just, like, a sudden realization that, like, oh, yeah, like, Spud isn't the kind of guy who is going to turn his life around. He's the kind of guy who is going to shoot it up his arm. And I think that, like I said, it's just, as a person who Trainspotting was very important to me, and many of my friends were defined in a way by, like, who we thought we were in Trainspotting, it was a real, like, gut punch and a real interesting, like, look back. And the type of thing that I wish that some of these reboots and past, you know, major sequels did better. And Blade Runner 2049 has a lot of similar stuff like that, but I think T2, just because it's so grounded in character rather than world, achieves a little higher.
Brian, I think my one thing with T2, I agree with all of what you say, but I think that my problem with it is that the actual plot is so like convoluted and is still about like these schemes in a way that I did want it to just kind of focus on how realistically these characters have like degraded. And then especially when you relate to what happens with Begbie, I don't want to go into any more specifics. Mm-hmm. I thought that reached a place of like cartoonishness in his character that really kind of undermined those really good things you were talking about. So by the end, I was like impressed, but also feeling like there were two movies at war with each other.
Yeah, I can understand that. It weirdly has, this is hilarious, but it weirdly kind of has the same final act problems that Sunshine does, where it's like, we can't figure out how to, we can't figure out how to really close this up. So what if we had a murderer running around? Yeah, it's really strange in that way. But no, T2, Trainspotting. And it's one of those ones that I watched again, and I was like, yeah, fucking holds up. Still number 9.
That last shot, too, is a fucking last shot for the ages.
Oh, man. All right. Bill Graham, number 8.
Number 8. That would be Paul Thomas Anderson's return to the screen, Phantom Thread. Much better than Inherent Vice, thank you. I think this film is such an interesting film experience, watching it in a theater with a room full of strangers. My screening in particular had a lot of elderly people, and I'm not sure if that's a reflection of the film, maybe the way the film was advertised, or if it was a reflection of the theater that I was in, the Angelica. I'm not sure, but there was a lot of old people. And at one point, I could tell when they started realizing that this was not necessarily a film for them. And it was about the halfway point, and they were like, what? And I live for those kinds of experiences where I don't know what the hell I'm getting myself into. And by the end of the film, I'm just so happy that it's gone there, that it went there full force, that this is one of those films. It sparked a lot of conversation. I've had a lot of really great conversations, whether it's on this podcast or whether it's listening to other people's podcast about this film. It was a delight to see how many people just were smacked upside the head by this film. And I think, you know, some people have said if this is Daniel Day-Lewis's final performance, that it's kind of sad because they don't like the movie. And I'd say, nah, this is a hell of a performance, and this is a good one to go off on. And it's got two hell of a performances from two leading ladies that are absolutely fantastic in it. And so, yeah.
Yeah. And also a movie that's gotten a shit ton of Oscar love.
Do you owe Victor 20 which is, bucks yet?
No, I haven't seen it again. Oh, so okay. I don't know if I owe him 20 bucks. All right. He also said he wouldn't pay me. Let me. So.
Yeah, he said that was funny money. Let's ask this since it's relevant, and also because unfortunately it was the last podcast you did, except for the Sundance thing that you just did earlier today. Brian, you're a fucking monster.
How am I a monster?
I'm saying you're a monster, as in like I'm impressed.
Oh, so like in a good way.
Yeah, would a beast be like a better use of language?
Yeah, I guess. Maybe. Yeah, maybe, because like I don't know, because if you're doing it the Jay-Z, Nicki Minaj,
I'm a motherfucking monster.
I'm a motherfucking monster. There you go. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Okay. Did our podcast conversation change a little bit of the tone that you're kind of viewing that film, even like without seeing it again?
No, not really, because I agreed with everything that you guys were saying and everything except how you were reacting to it. So I think I enjoyed the movie more only because my viewing was followed up by an interesting conversation. But
yes,
I really do. I do think I just need to watch it again to see if, knowing where it goes, I enjoy it a little more. But the conversation it was nice. It was a nice conversation, but it didn't sway me.
Okay.
It was all nice.
Right. It was a good conversation. Like, that's the type of movie. Like, it's funny because remembering Inherent Vice, I don't even think that the conversation that I had after that was very good. But at least the Phantom Thread one, you know, the movie has enough, and there's enough cool stuff in the edges and in the text that, you know, I enjoyed talking about it, especially because it wasn't like violent and angry. Michael Snydell, your number eight.
My number eight is a film I caught up a little bit later in the year, and it's a film called In This Corner of the World by director Sunao Katabuchi. It's a anime film about through the perspective of a young woman on the home front during World War II in Japan. And so it follows, it takes place, it starts about 5 years before World War II and lasts a little bit more than a decade. And so it just goes through her, meditates on her daily life. And, you know, it's really I think, important and interesting to see a very different perspective on, you know, the war front, and seeing how tedious and ritualistic life becomes when you're trying to support your country, whether, you know, it's like daily bombing runs or, you know, how you're rationing food to last 5 or 6 days. And it's there's a few things I really like about it. One is its art style, which is kind of a combination of kind of chibi, strange body proportion characters with like a digital backgrounds, and so this kind of combination of art styles is really impressionistic and creates a sensation that's kind of in this liminal space between kind of reality and purgatory, and then I'd say it's kind of comparable to something like Isao Takahata's Grave of the Fireflies, but somehow even more devastating. But it's...
Oh,
it's,
Jesus.
It's really, really excellent, and I really hope more people check it out.
Alright.
That last fucking sentence, holy shit, that's a hell of a sentence, man. Because if there's one thing that anybody has heard of Grave of the Fireflies is that movie is fucking deep and dark. Yeah, and sure. You were like, it bests it. And it's just like, ooh, okay. This sounds like something to watch on a very bright, sunny day.
Well, that's, I think that's what especially kind of put it over the top and put it in my top 10 is this, the distance.
You saw it on a sunny Sunday?
No, the distance between like this tediousness of their life and when something horrifying can strike. And how they need to just live through that. Like, you don't usually see that depicted with such, like, in such a matter-of-fact fashion.
All right. Well, my number eight is Dunkirk by Christopher Nolan. Perhaps one of, if not the best theatrical experience I had this year. And, I mean, I feel like I've gushed about it a lot. We did a whole podcast about it. I had an essay about it on the film stage. So I don't have to talk about it that long. It's a beautiful movie. The storytelling device of the mixed up times is brilliant and perfectly deployed. And it's visceral in a way that very few movies are. It is everything that every plasticine superhero movie wishes it could be. No superhero battle has thrilled me as much as this movie did. And it's perfect and good. So Dunkirk, number eight.
My ears will never be the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it knocked a decibel off or so. it's a hell of a theatrical experience. I think the unfortunate thing about this is much like how we just fucking ranted and raved about Mad Max Fury Road. I don't think the non-theatrical experience of this film is going to hold up. And so
I can say that unfortunately, because this is another one of the ones I watched. And oh, I made really? My wife watch it for the first time, and she was still having an anxiety attack. So if I had taken her to the 70 millimeter, she may have just legitimately died.
I made a mistake of not eating before seeing that movie. That was a terrible, terrible idea.
Oh, you were like, oh, this movie subbed 2 hours. Like, this will be fine.
Yeah. I am.
Rookie.
I will say I have a 55-inch television.
Okay.
So I don't know if that matters. But, you know, it's not huge, but it's big.
No, that's not gigantic.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like, you know, if you're watching it on your laptop, probably not. But on that screen in my house, yeah, it worked. It worked like gangbusters. So, okay. Yeah, that's my number 8. Dunkirk by Christopher Nolan. Let's move on. Lucky number 7, Bill Graham.
Sure. Lucky. Mine is Lady Bird. I really enjoyed this. Unfortunately, I was not on the podcast for it. I could not defend it as much as I would have liked. That being said, I really do think this is a great piece of art. I think this film speaks to a very particular sect of people, and I think it sings to them. I already like used that analogy. Yeah, but whatever. It works. This film just simply works from top to bottom. I think the people involved in it are giving a very thorough and honest performance. And I couldn't help but giggle and laugh internally listening to Saoirse Ronan give a Greta Gerwig performance at times. And I don't know, like, this is such an interesting debut solo feature for her that I'm just impressed in so many ways. And it's a film that I really enjoyed because it speaks to a middle classness, I guess, that is kind of living on the edge, where it's very apparent that their credit cards are maxed out and they are just kind of moving through the motions, just hoping to get one of their children out from under them so that they start providing for themselves and maybe give back. It's interesting in that way. And I think it reflects a lot of things. It's not a perfect film by any means, but so much of it is so good that it can't be left out of my top 10 for the year.
Yeah, I got nothing to say about this.
I know.
It's not on my top 10, or in fact in my top 15 actually. Good. But oh, Brian, I you're gonna love my number one, let me tell you.
I'm already prepared for the 3-hour long fight that will follow.
What I'd say about Lady Bird, Bill, I think you're right on in describing that, like, middle class aspect. I think that there's just a fullness to this portrayal of Saoirse Ronan's character and Lady Bird, and her experience, and that weird combination of being totally ignorant to what's around you, but also living so fully in the present. And I think that combination really makes this an experience that feels a lot more than a lot of your average coming of age stories. And, you know, it's a Laurie Metcalf, just a fantastic supporting performance.
She does great. Yeah.
All right. Michael Snydell, number 7.
Yeah. My number 7 is another one we haven't talked about on here. It's called Staying Vertical, and it's by director Alain Garodi, who's a French director whose recent breakout was a couple years ago. It was kind of a Hitchcockian cruising drama called Stranger by the Lake.
Oh, yes,
I heard about that.
I didn't like it very much at all. But this one, which is on Netflix, if anybody would like to check it out, it's a very interesting... it's kind of interestingly of a piece with films like Nocturama and The Ornithologist, and even something like Lost City of Z, where it's about a journey which doesn't really have a defined end. Like, it's about a character who finds their humanity in a limbo. and in this strange sense of like a strange combination of living your life and having major things happen and having some of them affect the rest of your life and other of them feel like they fade away as soon as they happen. And I know this is a strange description, but it's those detours and the ways that things matter and don't matter that make this just kind of such a almost like a magical experience. And there's just a sense of a longing and strangeness throughout the film without the filmmaking being that strange. Like, it's strange in such a subtle kind of sewed in way that it's like the rare film that feels hallucinogenic without like resorting to a lot of trickery.
And so you didn't like his other film?
No, not I. Yeah, no, I really didn't like the pacing or the rhythms or, yeah, I that was a real tough.
So this is like a complete and utter shift in tone and like pacing and everything like that.
The one thing I'd say it has in common, and Grotti has a reputation for, he's done something like 10 LGBT films. That there's definitely like a sexual fluidity which factors very strongly into like the character's worldview.
Okay.
I'm just glad that Michael is here, because I remember back in the day when Nick Newman was on this podcast.
Yes.
And everyone's top tens would be stuff that we talked about previously. And then Nick Newman would be like, my fifth favorite film was a small film. I don't know if anyone saw it. It's called On the Occasion of Remembering the Bird on the Turning Gate. And that is like me butchering the title, but that was literally one of the movies that he did. It was like On the Occasion of the Remembering the Turning Gate or something.
I know what you're on a park bench quietly waiting or some shit like that. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
No, I swear to God that the phrase turning gate was used in the movie title. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is super glad. On the occasion of remembering the turning gate.
Are you sure you're not talking about a pigeon sat on a branch reflecting on existence?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Because he definitely gave right that now. A high review too. Okay.
This says it's from 2002, so maybe I'm misremembering it as just something that he watched and wanted to talk about. But he definitely was the type of person who would pull out that kind of title and just be like, yeah, it was a really great movie.
It's on Netflix. It's not that hard to see.
No.
On the occasion of remembering the turning gate?
Films.
No. Staying vertical.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, to go back.
What we're trying to say, Michael, is we appreciate you.
Yes.
Okay.
Love
you
dearly. my number 7, talking about appreciating Michael, is Mother by Darren Aronofsky.
Yes. Yes.
Criminally overlooked for a bunch of Academy Awards that it should have gotten, especially a leading actress nom for its leading actress, Jennifer Lawrence.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Who I almost called Goodwin just then, which is not right. This is a great movie. We had a whole podcast about it. Michael couldn't function after a point, and we had to get Jordan to sub in. And I think that this is a movie that has a lot to say. It's bold in its allegory and in where it goes, and it has shaken me to my core, and I want to see it again, but at the same time, I don't know if I want to see it again, if you know what I mean? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
In one of those situations?
I know what you're talking about. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I definitely keep seeing, like, advertisements for it being on sale on Blu-ray right now, and I'm like, ooh, that's definitely one I want to get. And then I'm like, who do I want to sit down and watch this with? Not my parents. And I'm just like, And my girlfriend probably is not gonna want to experience this. Although I might just sneak that in.
My wife fucking loved it, but even
she's
like,
that's an act of violence.
I knew you were gonna say something like that, Michael. You were gonna be like, that's a terrible idea.
That's worse than sleeping with an underaged person.
Oh, Jesus.
So just gonna slowly start throwing shade.
I wish
Michael's
I could have I wish
pick.
I had was drinking tea right now so I could just spill it everywhere.
I get what? I should have made myself some toast that I could have buttered very loudly into the microphone.
God damn it.
Let the passive aggressiveness begin. Anyway, Mother, great film, great performances, great cinematography, great sound design. Another thing.
Fantastic sound design, yeah.
Why was it not, like, this is the type of thing
I don't know.
It being nominated just for that. But you know what? Awards are bullshit. It doesn't matter. Mother's great.
Yeah, it should have been nominated, considering all the Oscars are most everything. Mother fits in really well.
Yeah, it had the most sound design.
There's no doubt about that.
Outside of maybe the Phantom Thread, that's a fundamental
fucking fact.
Yeah.
Nah, not even close.
Most acting from Jennifer Lawrence. Most direction from Darren Aronofsky.
All right.
I mean, what do you want me to say, Michael? Many of your films are nominated for Academy Awards, so I can say the same goddamn thing. Except Timothée Chalamet, that guy doesn't do shit on the screen. But anyway, let's move on. I said I wanted this to be argumentative. I'm glad it's working out. Number six.
I'm still going to watch it again at some point.
I hope you do, and I fully contend I
was in a bad place that day.
I will bet you $20 that your opinion will not
change.
Real
money?
Bitcoin? Then we could talk.
$20 worth of Bitcoin? Is that like 1/100th of a Bitcoin?
I have zero fucking idea how Bitcoin works. Yeah, I have no idea.
There was a story that came out recently where 50 Cent apparently forgot that he got paid 700 Bitcoins, and now it's worth like multi-millions of dollars. Yeah, it's just like, oh, cool.
I heard about that, and that was hilarious. Yeah.
Did you guys hear that he made a video about 4 years ago where he was using... he was throwing money around, and it was singles because he was out of money. So the money that they were throwing around on a bed was singles.
Well, they're fucking lucky that he wasn't throwing. They're fucking lucky that he wasn't throwing 50 Cent like pieces out.
Hey-o.
That would have hurt.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on. We're a movie podcast. Yeah. We've been talking for an hour. We're only at number six. Number six, Bill Graham.
All right, this one is Raw. I really fucking love this movie, and I just absolutely wish that the advertising for this film hadn't done what it had done. I understand that this coming-of-age dark comedy film is a little bit of a hard sell considering it involves cannibalism, but at the same time, selling it as this insane, intense thriller horror experience probably wasn't the best idea considering what the film actually fucking is, which is none of those things. It's interesting because what it made me realize was how delicate and how precise you have to be for balancing a film that is a dark comedy like this, that has horror elements, that has craziness involved in it. And, you know, it makes me realize how great of a filmmaker Sam Raimi is in retrospect. And this film really shows me someone to start paying attention to in the future, because if I believe this was her directorial debut, if this is a directorial debut, holy shit, I can't wait to see where this person goes from here. It's confidently made. It is extremely well acted, and the setting for it is fucking nightmarish in like a real sense. Just the idea of being like learning to be a veterinarian in a location that also houses you, that also houses the school, that also feels like a prison in some ways, and there's hazing and there's like all of this other shit going on, and it just seemed like a bonkers experience in the middle of France. So yeah, Raw.
All right, Michael Snydell.
I think I had something to say about Raw. The last thing I'd say about Raw is I feel like that movie also has a really great sense of what it's like in the transition going from high school to college, and that weird like burst of energy and like
freedom.
Yeah, and freedom and how you react to that. And it, you know, she obviously takes a different route, but it's, there was something like really
who didn't
believable.
Try human flesh freshman year?
You know, some crazy frat parties. All right. Moving on. My number six is Josh and or the Safdie brothers. Good time.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah.
Our number one film of the year, by the way.
Yes. Number one on the film stage. Yeah. So Good Time. There's a lot to say about it. But I think the best way I've been describing it or trying to sell it to people is that it's a genre film that slowly reveals that it has a lot more to say about the world that its characters live in. Based on the structure, it is kind of a thriller and it takes twists and turns. But I think what I really like about it and why it became a film I thought about so much is that it also has a lot to say about how people get what they want by manipulating others. Robert Pattinson's performance here, two. This and Lost City of Z, like, are two performances this year where he really just disappears in a way that is nothing short of kind of eerie from what you expect from a major movie star. And he's a terrifying character in this, like someone who is polite and acts like he is just trying to do the right thing for his brother, but is willing to hurt anyone and put anyone in a bad situation for a seemingly noble goal. And I think the ways this looks at this complicates bureaucratic systems, the ways this tries to create characters who are, you know, way more than, you know, standard, you know, scumbags or anything like that. And the Safdies have always done a really good job with, you know, creating realistic characters, but this feels like it takes it to the next level and makes a portrait of these characters that is also incredibly entertaining and just a great experience.
I will be talking about this later, so I agree.
I will say that I really enjoyed this film, but at the time and still upon reflection, I think it's just so dark and just so dirty of a film experience that is going to put a lot of people off. And I'll say that Robert Pattinson's performance in this is a hell of a thing. He's such a slimy dirtbag. And I think I mentioned it on the podcast as well, but you know, I've known people like this that will just smooth talk themselves into any situation they basically want to. I think y'all mentioned he kind of skirts on his good looks. I absolutely refuted that at the time and still reiterate. I think he looks like a ball of trash.
Yeah, but all like the sexiest throughout this ball of trash.
Oh, Jesus Christ. No, no.
Maybe clean up a bit.
No.
It's a very shiny ball of trash.
it's a hell of a thing to see him like this. But, you know, having talked to the Safdie brothers in person and gotten to kind of know them a little bit, these are more filmmakers to absolutely keep an eye on, because they are just going to do more and more interesting things. And look, fucking thank God for Robert Pattinson for having the balls to take some filmmakers that don't really work with like high profile actors and like work with the guy from Twilight. Like, say what you will, but you know, he's obviously made enough money where he can pick and choose what he wants to do, and he chose to work with these guys and chose to be in a role that does not present him in a very positive light. So yeah, bravo all around.
Pattinson's 2018 too is just like, it's so bizarre. He's doing like a Claire Denis film, he's doing a Zellner Brothers film. Like, he like between it's weird to bring up Twilight again, but like Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson are like seeking out some of the most interesting directors working now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Woo.
I will say that my number six is also a grimy movie, and it has the word raw in the first word of the title. It is Brawl in Cell Block 99.
You son of a bitch. Good job.
Yeah.
Golf clap to that.
Thank you very much. Brawl in Cell Block 99, the newest film by S. Craig Zahler, stars Vince Vaughn, and it's fantastic. And like, S. Craig Zahler is like dark side Terrence Malick for me. It's like, these are guys who like know exactly what I want without ever having met me, give it to me every time, and I love it, and I want more of it, and I can't wait for the next one, and I need it in my life right now. And I rewatched Brawl in Cell Block 99 with my wife, who watched it with me the first time, and with my brother, who hadn't seen it previously, and just a goddamn great time at the movies. Like, it's a laser-focused, perfectly executed crime vengeance story, and just one of the most satisfying movies that I've ever seen, just in terms of, like, who gets what done to them and by whom.
How'd that pacing feel on the second time, Bren? Did it make perfect. Even more sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it did. I was worried that it would drag a bit, and my brother even said, like, he said, it felt like it was going really slow, but at the same time, I feel like it moved a lot faster than it actually was. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, what he was getting at was, like, the languid, kind of lived-in feeling of everything that, like, really, again, gets you invested in those characters so that when they start breaking each other, it means something. And you expect a movie like this to just open with a gunfight and move on to another gunfight and like bad shit happening all the time, but like all of the slow, like gentle, like it's like instead of diving into the pool, very slowly walking into it so that you have adjusted to the water temperature so that you don't even realize when you're in the deep end and it's got you. And it's a great movie. It's fantastic. And I can't wait.
And it's also scalding and you're in hell.
Yeah, exactly. It's the frog in the pot getting boiled. Yeah. You don't throw that fucking frog into a boiling pot. You slowly turn it up.
Sure, sure.
And my brother just had like the best reactions to like when they get to Red Leaf, cuz he was just like, what the fuck? What is happening? Like, who is this person? Like, is this real? Like, is this really happening? And I was like, yeah, this is in the reality of the movie. This is actually happening. Like, this isn't like him like projecting what the jail feels like. And then when they like take him down to the other level into Cell Block 99, he was just like, this shouldn't work. It's so crazy compared to how normal everything else was, but I'm in love. And I was like, yeah. Yeah, you are, Kevin. It's a great movie. All right. So that's the halfway point of our lists. We're at number five, top five time. Let's see if we can't move a little faster. Let's see if we can't. Woo. Just
Jesus, really? Okay.
Man, we've been talking for over an hour.
I know.
And we're only
on
to number five.
I know.
So, you know, make your points punchy and quirky and fast. Bill Graham, hit us.
Number five is a return to form for Pixar. Nice. Coco. I absolutely adored this film. What?
I said, hey, we were just talking about this.
Oh, yeah. I thought you said you already talked about this. And I was like, I think I'm
on
number five.
We all talked about it.
Yes. Again, we fucking did a podcast on this. But I will say that it's a rare film that makes me reflect on how I live my current life, and just thinking about how I interact with family and what kind of legacy we leave, and whether or not we leave a big enough legacy for other people outside of our immediate family and things like that to remember us. But more than that, like, okay, like, why don't we remember each other inside of your family? Why don't we remember each other inside of our own lineage and things like that? And, you know, it makes you start to think about ancestry.com and genealogy research and all of these other things. And before you know it, you're just like, holy shit, like, I'm such an asshole. Like, I don't know my aunt and uncle's favorite thing. I don't know this person. And these are people that are alive, you know? And so, yeah, it's just a beautiful film in so many different ways. It's entertaining. It makes me laugh. It's a thoroughly good surprise to watch and experience. And it's just a beautiful film in so many ways. I think it's so easy to look at this film and think that it's a movie with a white co-director who, you know, probably didn't live this life, and, you know, they're kind of mooching off of this Hispanic not even religion, culture. Belief,
tradition,
culture, yeah, tradition, all of those words, and yes, they do it right. And bravo. Yeah, all of those words. Yeah, they do it right.
Yeah, I enjoyed Coco. I have no problem with this selection. I think for me, it was missing that, like, one essential little, like, that one like truly Pixar-y thing. I think that, I don't know, I can't quite make sense
I bawled like a fucking baby towards the end of this movie. Like Jesus. Oh man.
And I was sitting next to best song.
Of course.
Remember
probably for the wrong song according to Brian, but you know,
I think Poco Loco is better, but
I love it.
Yes. Michael Snydell, anything to add?
I don't really want to get into it. I just think it's I just think the narrative's, there's a little bit too much going on.
All right.
On second watch, okay. I felt that that second act is a little crowded.
Well, then why don't you tell us what your number five film was so we can shit all over it?
Sure.
Yes. Yes.
You can shit all over. You know what? Never mind. my number five is Stephen Cohn's Princess Cyd, which Brian mentioned earlier.
Loved it.
And so Stephen Cohn has long made films that are really kind of really appeal to me and important to me, because he makes films about the intersection of faith and sexuality. And so I've talked about it on here probably at some point, because I've talked about everything. I went to Catholic school for 12 years, and so I had a very contentious experience with religion for a good part of my life. And I have also had a contentious experience with my sexuality and queerness and things like that. And so Stephen Cohn's films, I think other than maybe Scorsese and less so Malick, I think he's one of the best directors making films about religion right now, because he recognizes that religion is not ever a binary thing that can be solved, and that people's viewpoints on religion and their own identity are not things where you need to come to an agreement, but rather understand the complexity of each other. And that's what I like so much about his films as well, is they take their characters as they come and take them on their own viewpoints and their own views of the world. And as a result, it almost feels utopian in how empathetic it is. And yeah, I absolutely adore this film. And quick plug his other previous films. The Wise Kids, I think, is available on Hulu. And Henry Gamble's Birthday Party, I think, is available on Netflix. And they're both worth checking out. So, yeah. Stephen Cohn.
Firmly
just
agree.
A really excellent filmmaker.
Yeah.
I agree.
All right. My number five is a movie about a ghost.
Really? Oh.
Yeah.
A ghost story?
It is a ghost story by David Lowery.
Woo!
Starring Casey Affleck.
I thought this would be higher.
You thought it would be higher?
I did.
I did too. My top five is like super strong.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah. I was a little surprised. It's one of, like, I would say that three and through five, I could probably shuffle however I want. And so at some point, I just decided to leave them as they lay. Because A ghost story is fantastic. It's utterly fucking wonderful. And it's moving. And it's striking. And it's not like most other things that you'll see in cinemas. And it is heartbreaking in times that you almost wouldn't expect it to be. Best use of subtitles in a movie ever. Best use of pie. And, yeah.
It's, best use of Casey Affleck, where he's never in this fucking movie.
Yeah, he's in a sheet. Underneath that sheet. And that it's just like, there's something like, the movie is like beautiful and whimsical and also like wrenching and heartbreaking. And it's a rare delicacy. It's a balancing act. It's like a souffle and it never deflates and it's great the whole way through. So
Rooney Mara wasn't nominated.
Nothing in this movie was nominated.
Yeah. She would be supporting if she was anything, wouldn't she? As I think about it.
Probably. I mean,
that's
she
a
is
really
the lead
weird
actress,
supporting.
I think her
yes.
role could be considered a supporting role, but also she's like
sure.
the focal point of the movie. But I think
she's the visual of the movie. I think it's unfortunate because, you know, Casey Affleck is under that fucking sheet the whole time. So that's a weird fucking performance if they ever nominated that. Like, can
I would
you imagine
love that?
Yeah, that'd be a hell of a thing.
What was I going to say? I think this movie
you know what he should have given the best actress award in that fucking sheet. I think that would have been a classy move.
Just completely silent.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's better that he dropped out.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? This movie could have been nominated for editing, directing, score, original screenplay, in all honesty. Because even though there's not a lot of dialogue, I think people don't like realize that like dialogue isn't all that a screenplay matters about. I mean,
well, I think people are confused about like what a fucking screenplay is because they see the finished product and they don't quite realize
yeah.
like there was an actual screenplay that got that financed and got that film filmed and everything like that. They weren't just kind of making it up on the fly. So
yeah, exactly. I think it's easier to understand why a thing wins for adapted screenplay because you're thinking about like, oh right, it was a book or it was something else and then you had to turn it into it. But like and so therefore they're looking at it as an act of adaptation instead of an act of pure creation. And they don't realize that like an original still has to do all those same things.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
yep.
Number four, Bill Graham.
Number four. Star Wars The Last Jedi.
What?
Yeah, it surprisingly, I was looking over my top 10 recently and I realized that I hadn't placed it as high as I should. There's a lot of reasons for that. Part of it is just simply because it feels almost too easy to put it where it is in my list. I'm a Star Wars addict. I fucking watch the cartoons for God's sake. Like, holy shit, come on. And yet this feels, the reason I put it on my list, especially as high as I did, is mainly just as a middle finger to all the backlash that happened to this film, because holy shit, so many people had such just an anal reaction to whether it was like Luke's whole story arc and so many different factors in this movie that I just can't help but just go wah wah wah. This movie's fucking great. Like it's it breaks the rules of so many different things that you think Lucasfilm kind of stands for and Kathleen Kennedy stands for. It does so many things that you would expect her to kind of rebel against as the head of Lucasfilm now. And Rian Johnson has been given the keys to the kingdom, and by all accounts, he fucking adores his role in it. I'm not sure whether it's just him being so fundamentally enjoying this experience that he can't see that he struggles to kind of make it his own. And yet this film feels very much of a Rian Johnson piece in so many different ways, whether it's all of these things kind of at the end crashing together. It's a beautiful film from beginning to end. The sequence with, why can't I remember? Laura Dern. And like just so many different things. The fact that fucking theaters in this modern age had to warn audiences and say, hey, yeah, there's a sequence where it goes silent for for like 30 seconds. Don't freak the fuck out. Like everything is normal. You know, like this is modern age cinema where we're taking probably the largest pop culture phenomenon in the last 30, 40 years and just kind of jumbling it up just enough to give people that have watched and paid attention to this a thrill that they didn't expect. And so, yeah. And for this to be Carrie Fisher's final performance is just a hell of a hoorah.
I liked this movie. It was very good. Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I think that it's funny that like the theaters had to warn people about that, because I think that that says a lot about like people's faith in a theater's ability to get it right.
I think it also says something about a national attention or a global attention span.
Well, yeah. I think it's more of just them like freaking out because of just the idea that a film like this would go silent for 30 seconds, right? It's like,
it's not even
what?
30 seconds. It's like 10 at
most. I know.
Yeah. That's what's crazy about it.
I know. It's enough for someone to flip the fuck out and get out of their theater or get
like,
out of their seat
Star Wars
real quick.
Movie. It doesn't do arty dumb shit like go completely quiet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Except it's totally just an anime scene. Like, have you read, like,
well,
that's
yeah,
Gundam
exactly.
Wing
it is.
Shit.
It's, I mean, you know, like Lucas very clearly drew from like a lot of great Japanese directors, and Rian Johnson's doing the same thing.
Sure.
And like, it's just so funny that like people would flip the shit because they're like, oh my God, it went quiet. And that's like, that's kind of my thing. Like if I saw that in an AMC theater after like having to go through all the shit with the commuter, I probably would have been like, oh, of course these fucking idiots somehow screwed up and muted the movie now. Because I'm pretty sure they're the people who literally did start this movie without sound in one place, and then people were rioting.
Yeah.
Oh, yep. Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
So that's just, I mean, like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, if there's any through line to this whole podcast right now, it's the theatrical experience is going to hell, and no one's helping. All right, Michael. Snidell.
Didn't Griffin talk about some experience along those lines on Blink Check? Or he was
yes.
at
he
a
was,
theater where that happened?
No, he was telling the story of that theater.
Oh. Yes, that's what it was. Yeah.
All right.
We couldn't go a fucking podcast without mentioning Blink Check.
I was going to say the best part of that is that David Sims brought up my favorite tweet related to The Last Jedi, which is the person who tweeted like, so bummed, like I was gonna watch The Last Jedi when suddenly the crowd just started chanting the town until the movie theater put on Ben Affleck's The Town, which is just the most absurd thing I've ever heard, and I love it.
It's like a drill tweet.
Yeah, pretty much. So what was it? Like, this whole thing reeps of patriarchy. I screamed as I flipped over the July 4th barbecue or something like that. Anyway.
Oh, God.
Let's not talk about our favorite tweets. Let's talk about our favorite movies from 2017 like we're supposed to. Michael Snydell, you're number four.
My number four is Bertrand Bonello's Nocturama.
Fuck that movie.
We did a podcast on it.
We did do a podcast on it. It's still on Netflix. So Nocturama is it's really interesting to me for the exact reasons that makes a lot of people really angry. So it's a movie about young terrorists. That's not a spoiler to say that. You find that out immediately about young terrorists who you have no idea what their motive is. And you watch them enact a terrorist act and then try to escape. And that is the whole movie. But I think what is so interesting about this movie is it's not really about terrorism in any way. It's more about what it's like to be a young person living in this time and not knowing what revolution is other than reading about it in history books or thinking about philosophy and making great change, but not knowing what that looks like in a modern time where everyone, you know, photographs every moment of their life and everything feels like it matters and therefore nothing matters. And so this film is just kind of, it's a messy examination of that feeling and what it's like to want to have that change and to want to be remembered. And also to try to understand a world that you were born into without any control of what it looked like.
I really liked this film. It was great. And it was my number 13 film of the year.
Huh. It also, the cinematography is, the direction and cinematography in this movie, especially in the first 45 minutes, is perfect. Like,
I will add that to the last 10 minutes as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
The camera movement. Yeah. It's, yeah. I understand why people don't like it.
Cinematography is good.
I understand why people don't like it, but I hope people give it a shot.
Yeah. All right. So my number four is a little old movie called Lost City of Zed.
Oh, woo.
Yeah. So this is
you
by,
said Zed. Good job.
I did. I made certain I did that. This is a fine movie, one of two Robert Pattinson starring-ish films that I have on my my list, and Charlie Hunnam gives his I was gonna say his best performance, but maybe I should say his only good performance.
Ooh,
damn!
I'm sure that I've
shots fired. What about Undeclared?
You know, King Arthur is actually on Netflix or HBO. I can't remember. It's on one of those. I think it's on Amazon. I heard it's not as bad as people say. So,
maybe I'll watch it. No, I won't.
It's Guy Ritchie, man.
How fucking weird would it be if I watched Legend of the Sword before I watched Mudbound?
not that weird.
Not like this. What was I gonna say? This is a beautiful movie. It's a ripping adventure yarn, and it has all the stuff that I want from a jungle movie. It's got the natives, it's got the rafts, it's got piranhas. Pretty sure there's a snake at some point. And it's really it's one of the few cinematic representations of what's the word I'm looking for? Like, not madness.
Impotence?
Impotence? He has many children, so I don't know what you're talking about. No, it's obsession. Like, you know, a lot of times, like, a director will make a movie about obsession, and it's, like, a loosely veiled thing about him as a director. Whereas this one truly does feel like it has something deeper to say about the human spirit and what drives people to do things and go places and discover. And I think given the way that we are in the world today, where we don't really like to go out and find new things, we don't like to move beyond our bubble or challenge the status quo, I think that is a really interesting thing to take a look at. And one of the best final shots in a movie this year.
He's got a lot of really good final shots. Brian, I think I might have mentioned it during the podcast, but I will reiterate, you really need to read The Lost City of Z. It is... What?
Zed.
Oh, no, it's literally called, it's like the actual... that's right. It's not spelled out Zed. That's just how they pronounce it.
Yeah, British people are
anyways,
weird.
Yes.
And Canadians.
Yeah. but yeah, the book is absolutely fantastic, and it really, like, it touches not just on Percy, but it touches on, like, the other people surrounding him, because there were a number of expeditions to try and be the people that found out what happened to Percy, and the people that actually found out, like, oh, was this actually El Dorado and stuff like that, and it's absolutely insane the links that people went through. So.
I got my mother his new book, Killers of the Flower Moon, for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to stealing that from her same, when she's done with it.
Okay, that's the same writer?
Yeah, Gran.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's my number four. Anyone got anything to say about it?
I should be on Amazon, right? It's an Amazon movie?
It is on Prime,
I don't know.
Prime,
I have
yes.
it on Blu-ray, so...
What'd you say, Mike?
You know, I have mixed feelings about this film overall. Hunnam's probably a big barrier for me, honestly. But I will say the last 20 minutes of this are just about the closest I came to, like, seeing Transcendence on a screen.
Nice. All right. So let's go to number three. Top three time.
Are you talking about the Wally Pfister movie?
Ha ha ha. That was a terrible joke, and I hate you for reminding me that movie exists. Number three. Number three. Bill
oh,
Graham.
That's mine. Yeah. That's mine. I just watched it again today. It's Get Out. Hell yeah, motherfuckers. This movie is fucking great and delightful from beginning to end. I say that as a white person, so I understand why I would take that tone.
Delightful is quite the word.
This is a wonderful movie up until the final 10 minutes where that what was someone had a tweet about like how I think it was like someone in the Trump cabinet like said that they liked Get Out. And someone had a tweet about the fact that like they probably liked it up until the point that all the white people started getting killed. It's like it has such a sad ending. What with all the white people dying.
That's not how that film's supposed to go. Yeah. No.
By the way, I guess spoiler for Get Out, but it's a fantastic movie, and everyone who's listening to this should have seen it.
Yes, I agree.
Nice.
No, that's a real statement. That's a real statement. I'll stand by that.
Justification to spoil the movie.
Nice. Yeah, fuck yeah.
I'm gonna, from now on, if I've seen the movie, I'm spoiling it. So, Michael, you're going to say like, oh, yeah, my number three is X. And I'm going to be like, best part of that movie was when Johnny stabbed Sally with a kitchen fork.
Stop giving
Don't give
away
it away.
My next movie. Come on.
Anyways, so this film is brilliant from beginning to end. I didn't quite realize how much Little Rel in this film just absolutely, he telegraphs everything, and it's so funny to watch it a second time and realize like how much you just wish, I believe the main character's name is Chris, how much you just wish Chris would just fucking listen to his best friend and just be like, oh shit, yeah, this is a bad situation. I need to get the fuck out of here. And he never does it. And it's such a clever like buildup of tension. My girlfriend, while she was watching it, she was constantly just like, what the fuck is going on in this movie? Like, why is shit so weird? Like, why is her family so weird? And why is all this shit keep happening? And I'm just like, I feel like that's how more than likely there's a lot of situations where black people find themselves in and they start to wonder that to themselves as well. Like, why does this weird shit keep happening to me? And I think it's telling that we get to experience that through another character's eyes, as a main character in this film. And, you know, watching it watching it on the big screen was a hell of an experience, because just to see the audience reactions and things like that, for them to cheer at certain moments when Chris kind of gets the one up on people. I will reiterate it again. I think this film makes the teacup the greatest weapon I've ever seen in a movie. Yeah. And it scares the shit out of me. And she noticed as soon as Catherine Keener, who is fucking phenomenal in this film, even though she does like very little, like she's not doing that much, but what she's doing here is fucking phenomenal. And it plays off of her just like being such a lovely woman in so many movies, where you're just like, because wasn't she in 40-Year-Old Virgin?
Yeah, she was the love interest in 40-Year-Old Virgin. But yeah, like the movie is like predicated on,
she's so nice.
Yeah, you just want to be like, you want to listen to her. She's like, she commands your attention through her kindness.
All of Nicole Hall of Senders films have Keener as that type of character as well. Like, that's
Who?
Nicole Hall of Center. Like, she, enough said.
Has her in what vein? Like, being.
Yeah, like this, like, upper class, like, liberal politeness. Like, it's kind of really just weird lovely. That she's kind of playing herself a little bit here.
Yeah.
Same with Bradley Whitford.
I just love who Jordan Peele casted this movie. I think he just cast it so well, even to the point of like casting Allison Williams, who, look, I've never seen Girls, but apparently she's like plays completely different in Girls.
Yeah, she's
she's
incredibly selfish. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, she's everyone in Girls is like a horrible person, but yes, she is. But I mean, like, markedly so. It's the same way that you'd say everyone in Mad Men is a horrible person.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Except and, for and then
some
Cosgrove.
People would. Yeah. Oh. Okay. I'd have to reflect on that.
Well, when we launch our Mad Men spinoff podcast, we'll have a whole episode devoted to Ken Cosgrove. I'll just say I watched this movie with my wife. After having seen it in the theater, it almost made my top 10. It did not. But it's super good. And when it was over, she actually said, if that's not in your top 10, I'm going to hit you. And I got hit. So that's just the way the world is sometimes. But yeah, she had a lot of the same reactions. Just like, my God, they're so fucking weird. What's going on? This is horrible. And then when the ending is happening, she was like almost on her feet cheering. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Michael Snydell.
My number three has already been mentioned, but it's Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread.
Yeah, the one that ends with...
God damn it, Brian. will you...
Am I right? Anyway.
All right, I guess we're not going to bleep that out. But
no, I'm totally going to bleep all that out.
Well, that bleep you just heard was Brian spoiling the end of the movie, but that's not what makes the movie great. So, PTA is a director that's been around for a while now. I think Hard Eight was early 90s, I believe, and then I guess his first breakthrough would have been Boogie Nights, and I think that was 94, 95. I don't have
Hard
years
Eight
in front
was
of me.
96.
Okay, never mind. Hold on. When was Boogie Nights then? Because I thought Hard Eight was his first film. Okay, and Boogie Nights was 97.
Yeah.
So anyway, PTA has been in the public consciousness for decades now. And
going on 21 years.
I've always liked his films, but especially in the last... three films, not excluding his documentary Junin, I think he's become a lot more strange, but also a lot more of a expansive director than he was in the past. He's focusing and creating stories that work on layers that mediate the own viewers watching at the same time. He's playing with genre expectations and subverting them, and he's just having a hell of a good time while he does it, making movies that are incredibly entertaining. I'm not going to debate Inherent Vice here, but I think Inherent Vice and The Master are two films that have a great sense of humor and avoid the self-seriousness that they could given the subject matter. And I think Phantom Thread as well is this incredibly entertaining, enthralling, engrossing experience that also has a lot to say about the ways that relationships shift power, what we do in order to, or excuse me, how we compromise, and just for fun, it undermines all the bullshit genius prestige biopics we've had over the years by making Daniel Day-Lewis into just a magnificent dickhead. Bill already talked about the two performances. Leslie Manville and Vicky Krieps are fantastic. Vicky Krieps as well, especially, I think, takes a role that could very easily be in the background, and I think she steals the movie away from Daniel Day-Lewis.
And she... Yeah, I, we already talked about The Phantom Thread, so sure. I'm fine to skip right on to the next one, which would be mine. Oh, man. My number three film is a Sprite bottle filled with LSD called Good Time.
Woo!
Yeah. I didn't really realize it until we were talking about it, that my three and my four both involved the former Mr. Edward Cullen, Robert Pattinson, mm-hmm. who has been great in almost everything that he's done post-Twilight. And
how long are we going to mention Twilight when he's in...
It's going to be the first fucking thing on his reel year. When he dies.
Yeah, more
I'm just
than
letting
likely.
You know that right now. He will, no matter how great he is, he will never escape it. Like, everyone still talks about the fact that Sly Stallone was in that fucking softcore porno movie.
Okay, sure.
Okay, maybe we don't talk right, about it enough, right. But it's true. So, Good Time is a grungy, grimy, punk rock little thriller all about a very bad person who's trying to do a good thing poorly, and it's fucking great. It's amazing, and it's infused with so much madness and weirdness and oddity, and it's just a nonstop sprint into a single night of utter ridiculousness that culminates in really the only way that it ever could. And I think that it's just this, like, hazy, fluorescent, and neon-soaked hellscape that somehow is also one of the most entertaining movies I saw this year.
Yeah, Sean Price Williams' cinematography. Yeah. Speaking of, like, cinematographers, I'm so excited for that he's going to be in this business for just decades. Like, that's so exciting.
I know. It's and it's the same thing with the Safdie brothers. Just, like, I'm glad that we've got these people who are looking out for the future of cinema.
And who understand New York really, really well.
Oh, my God. The movie is Queens as shit. anyway, let's move on to our number twos. Bill Graham, what is your first loser?
First loser.
Yeah, it's second place a good way to first put it. Loser.
Yeah, it's a hell of a first loser. It's Princess Sid. This, you know...
Damn it,
guys,
this is ruining my bit. It's impossible to spoil.
Yeah. Guys, this film is delightful in so many ways. I really was not expecting it. I think in a lot of ways, our top 10 should reflect things that we want people to seek out more than just necessarily like, oh, like I absolutely adored this film. Because as Brian has kind of mentioned, our top five ends up kind of being very easy to kind of move around and like navigate through and just be like, oh yeah, like that was fantastic and that was fantastic and that was fantastic and two more times. So this film just cannot come with a recommendation enough, because what it does is so key to what I think cinema at large should absolutely be striving to do. And that's to ultimately give us something to kind of chew on and chew over and maybe discuss with friends and things like that. This film absolutely does that and more. And what I think is so interesting is that this film shows that experience of having a conversation and having kind of minds changed and maybe actually showing people talk and affect each other during the film itself. The performances are wonderful, but I think more than anything, it's how they talk to each other and the grace that they do it with. And the fact that they're not shouting at each other, the fact that you're just sitting down and basically having a conversation that is deep and it's heartfelt and just emotional, and it does a great job of like having them affect each other. And you just don't see that on screen very often, where they're talking about things that actually mean something to them overall. And whether religion or sexuality and things like that, like, touch you, it doesn't matter as much, because you can understand where these characters are coming from. And so I think that's the most affecting part of this film, is just to watch these characters kind of grow up and realize, you know, that each other have something to say about their current situation, and they have something to gain from that knowledge and that experience with each other. So,
well, yes, I've, you know, Michael and I have already talked about this one, so obviously we're all in agreement. Is this the only film that we all three have chosen?
Maybe. That's interesting. I think so.
I think Michael and I both had Brawl.
Yes.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think we've been...
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. 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 Michael and I had Good Time. That's interesting.
We might need to do an episode of Princess Sid. I mean, we've talked about it, but maybe we should actually do that.
Yeah, there's going to be a point where there's nothing out, and maybe we can get Steven back on as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, Michael Snydell, what's your number two film?
Well, my number two film is Frederick Wiseman's Ex Libris, which
I can't spoil this one either, because I don't know what the fuck it is.
Which has a Bill alienating 3 hour and 17 minute runtime.
But delightful. Where do I pee at this movie? Tell me.
Right on the floor, Bill.
In all seriousness, Frederick Wiseman, he's one of the best documentarians we have. And admittedly, I only saw my first Wiseman film a few years ago when I saw In Jackson Heights. Especially in the last decade plus of his career, I believe, he's focused specifically on New York. And so after National Gallery and after In Jackson Heights, which was obviously about Jackson Heights, Ex Libris looks into the 100 branches of the New York Public Library.
My God, it's a 3.25 hour long documentary about the library.
And it's fantastic. So
whatever you say, Fraser Crane.
No, it is admittedly hard to try to say why Wiseman's films are so exhilarating, which is a crazy word to use. But I think what he's able to do with representing the library is create an understanding of how the... create an understanding and an argument for a library is not only a necessary like public institution, but an inherent reminder that the library like infiltrates every part of our daily life, from, you know, entertainment to infrastructure to education to every part. And being able to get an overview as it kind of skims through each of these places and, you know, spends time with people like Elvis Costello talking about, you know, his experience writing or songwriting to academics, you know, like Richard Dawson talking about atheism to you know, avant jazz quartets, to things like the I'm sorry, to things like administrative things, and being able to get an understanding of how all of these systems work together and how they help people, and being able to just see people in that moment it sounds so simple to just say that he uses his fly on the wall camera style to just watch people. And sometimes it feels like you're watching for a long time, but it's always a rewarding experience. I would probably recommend In Jackson Heights just a little bit more, but I didn't think I was going to love these films, but I highly, highly recommend Wiseman's films if you've never given them a chance.
I'm going to be completely honest with you. There's very little chance that I'm going to do that.
That's fine.
But no, it sounds super interesting. I'm just imagining, like, as a father with, like, very limited time in my hands, like, getting over the mental hurdle necessary to say, I will watch a 3-hour and 17-minute long documentary about libraries.
Wait, maybe you should watch In Jackson Heights then, Brian, because that... It specifically looks into a community, and that might be more.
That might be a good
up your alley. Yeah.
Yeah, I may do that then. Ex Libris, meaning from the library of. It's also the term that you use for the stamp that you put in the inside of a book to say who it's owned by.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Bill. Were you going to say something?
I was going to say I've worked in the library, so I think I might actually want to watch this. So I might give it a shot soon.
Awesome.
Did you mention any streaming platforms it might be on?
No, I think it might. He just all of his films recently came to a library website.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
not sure.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure which one. And I think online... you can stream it rent it on his official website. I got it through press means, but I know that there are ways to see it.
Okay, cool. Was that in the Big Magnolia pack?
I'm sorry?
Was that in the Big Magnolia package?
I'm not sure. That actually sounds kind of familiar.
Deadline Hollywood reports that all of his catalog is heading to the free streaming service Canopy with a K.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate that.
You are very welcome. So my number two film is a little animated short called World of Tomorrow. Ooh. World of Tomorrow, mm-hmm. Episode 2, The Burden of Other People's Thoughts. Did anyone else actually see this?
I have not.
I never got around to it.
Oh my God, you people are fucking the worst.
I didn't really like the first one that much, but It's Such a Beautiful Day.
Get off of the podcast.
It's Such a Beautiful Day is one of my top five of the decade. Like, I want to be clear. I'm part of the Hertzfeld tribe, but World of Tomorrow didn't really do it for me that much.
Brilliant. World of Tomorrow Episode 2, The Burden of Other People's Thoughts, is equally brilliant. And, yeah, it's just great. Between the animation... and the means in which it is produced, which is basically he interviews his, like, niece, who was 4 and then 5 when he produced this film, I think, or 3 and 4. It was a year off from when he did World of Tomorrow. And then he just takes her, like, disparate thoughts and ideas and then cuts them up and then has another actress voice her character, which is a future version of the character that he creates with his niece's words. It's very strange. It's hilarious. And it's so deep and existentially horrifying and yet so buoyant in a way. It's hard to truly explain had the impact of this film, but it is something else, and it is something that you really, and it's 23 minutes long. You can rent it for $5 on Vimeo, and you should all check it out.
Is it really part two? Is it very much like the second part of the story?
It's you know what's funny? I don't think you have to see the first one to really get this one. So it's still Emily.
All right.
Prime. Mm-hmm. But she is being visited by a different future self. And still being a very young girl, Emily Prime is still not quite understanding what's going on.
Okay.
Sure.
But whereas the other one was kind of this concept of like sharing a life, this second episode is more about what it takes to construct an individual life of one's own.
Okay.
It's really interesting. It's very interesting. And
is it the same visual style as well? Sorry.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
With
nice.
A little circle, stick and triangle, your and stick arms and legs. And there's something so weird because like my daughter has gotten to the point where she will like babble endlessly without using any actual words, but her inflection and the way that she moves her arms and like changes her face lets me know that like she's saying something, she believes that she's communicating. And so it's very interesting to see the way that Hertzfeld has taken like the next cognitive step, which is actually having words and trying to put an idea across, and adapted it into this weird kind of formal play. And it's really quite fantastic.
All right.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'll check it out this week.
Good. You'll have to let me know if it would have cracked your top 10. So that's my number two. All right, here we are.
I think the only thing that could crack my top 10, which I wasn't quite able to get to, was Bahubali 2.
Okay. Number one film.
I was going to say Paddington 2. I really need to fucking see that movie, because having seen Paddington 1, that is delightful.
Paddington 2.
That's 2018, though.
That's 2018 for us here in America.
Yeah, Bill. Oh. Us here in America.
There's still time.
Well, it came out this year.
Did it? I mean, I don't. When did it come out in the U.S.?
It came out this year. It came out in 2018. Yeah. It came out 2018. So I feel like I missed it. So.
Yeah, I need to see it too.
Well, it's fine. You have 52 weeks until you can.
Not long enough.
Oh man! All right, so let's talk number one films of the year. Now that closing in on 2 fucking hours of this.
Oh boy,
Bill Graham, what is your number one film of 2017?
It's Mother, motherfuckers.
Yeah, the one where and then she. Yeah,
and then it fucking. All right, yeah.
Stupid kissing.
I love this fucking movie.
Every single fucking thing that we just said.
That's all right. I love this fucking movie from beginning to end. It is cocoa bananas. It is bonkers to the extreme. The final, like middle, the middle, like big sequence in this movie is such a nightmarish conglomeration of so many like hellscapes and finales in cinema that it's just mind-boggling that a studio would finance it, b they would put this on like 1500 screens nationwide, and c that it even fucking exists. This is a crazy ass movie that you can read so many things into, whether you want to read it as a parable about the Bible, or maybe you want to read it about the environment, or maybe you want to read it about a situation where Darren Aronofsky is frustrated with his wife who is more popular than him, or whether you want to read it where Darren Aronofsky is the tortured artist and his wife is his wife in this film and just can't seem to figure him out. And he's such a genius that it doesn't matter. And maybe she yells at a lot of people about a sink. I don't know. Like, there's so many ways to take this a film, or it could just be a fucking nightmare from beginning to end, which I think is exactly what it was for Michael. So in that way, it works in so many different ways.
Any movie that can send Michael into a psychological tailspin deserves to be on our top 10 lists.
I don't want this movie to be responsible for this. I'm going to go on record and say it was medication that day, because that movie doesn't deserve this honor.
But it did, Michael. But yes, it did. And unlike me, when I was given a severe case of post-traumatic stress from Manchester by the Sea, I was able to soldier through, and you had to bow out.
I'd rather people know that I have mental illness than have mother affect me.
Jesus. Okay. Anyways, this movie is delightful. It is a hell of an experience. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I don't know. It touches all of my buttons, where it's just such a wow, bonkers scenario I fucking adore Jennifer Lawrence's performance in this. I think she's giving it a hell of a thing. I'm so glad that they are apparently not together anymore, because if that had been a continual thing,
with another 25-year-olds.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Go ahead, spoil that for me.
Wait, who is he with?
Oh, I said, don't know. Spoil that for me.
Suki Waterhouse from
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
He found another fucking blonde. Jesus. All right, whatever.
Just talk about a step down.
Yeah. Well,
this feels catty. Whatever. We should move on.
God.
What were you originally going to say, Brian?
Oh, I don't even remember now. Something about how great Mother is.
Yeah.
Probably.
I don't know. It's out on DVD and Blu-ray.
Yeah, check it out. It came out just in time for Christmas. and I did not. This is one of the ones I haven't been able to see it again. But it did. It did make my wife throw up in the theater, and she said that she loved it and it was great, and she probably never wants to see it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Michael Snydell. What's your best film of the year?
Oh, Jesus. Oh, man. Well, Brian, my favorite film of the year, not best, my favorite film of the year is Luca Guadagnino's Call Me By Your Name. I don't know. What else can we say about this one? We pretty much said everything we can. If anyone hasn't listened,
how about them peaches? To
that fateful episode and heard all about those peaches, or dem peaches, as Bill said.
Peaches. Peaches. Drinker.
All right, so Call Me By Your Name is the latest film by Guadagnino, who's previously done florid melodramas like A Bigger Splash and I Am Love, films that are very clearly influenced by, stories of alienation, like by filmmakers like Michelangelo Antonioni and Roberto Rossellini. And there's a very clear line of influence to a lot of Eastern art house. Or not, excuse me, not Eastern, European art house directors. Jesus Christ. Okay. Call Me By Your Name is his latest film, and I think it's his strongest film, even though it's a lot less messy than his previous films. I think what made this resonate so much with me this year are the two main performers, Timothée Chalamet and Armie Hammer, but just also how this gets across something about first crushes, the messiness of it, the power and need to have heartbreak early in life, the way that relationships change us, and the steps we take to becoming persons, or excuse me, a person later in life. And I just think Call Me By Your Name is one of the strongest in recent years portrayals of that. Other people on this podcast disagree.
Yes, they do. I will say the one thing that that movie really like gave to the world of me, like the thing that it has added to my life is the number of uncomfortable conversations I've had to have with actual friends of mine who listened to that episode and talked about how fucking triggered they were. Like, that's like the greatest gift of all is the incredible amount of discomfort that has entered into my life just from having people listen to that episode.
Hmm. So, Brian, your number one is
"Song to Song" by Terrence Malick.
Mm-hmm.
All right, credits.
All right, tell me why, because I like "Night of Cups"
because it doesn't involve any adults trying to have sex with teenagers.
Brian,
let's. I don't know. It's great. So we talked about this on the podcast and we gushed over it a lot. I don't think either of you were there.
I was with Nick Newman. Yep.
Oh, it was you and Nick Newman. Okay.
Yes.
So yeah, first of all, it's interesting to see Terrence Malick really give a woman the center stage in his film. I don't think it's really happened since, I would say, The New World, because even in something like Tree of Life, where Jessica Chastain's mother character was a primary figure, she was definitely being viewed through the lens of a man remembering his childhood. I like how messy he is able to let Rooney Mara's character be, and the ways in which the story kind of revolves around her and her maturation. It's the first Terrence Malick film that really feels like it has a villain, which I wasn't sure was going to work for me, but Michael Fassbender Mephistophelian kind of situation.
Faust. Yeah.
Yeah. He's great in it. And I just, I like this new edgy kind of weird Terrence Malick that we're getting. Like this is a Terrence Malick who's allowing his philosophy to get infected by the messiness of life more. And I feel like To the Wonder, Knight of Cups, and now this have been like a triptych that has been trying to progress to get him to the point where he could make Song to Song, which is a movie that it doesn't really pass judgment on anything the characters do morally, but it does pass judgment on what they do ethically. It's the ways in which they lie to one another that really hurt one another, rather than the things that they're doing, you know, hurting their soul. It's an interesting thing. I like the fact that I've been to Austin. I've been to the Austin City Limits Festival, and you know, it's still that type of thing where when Malick gets together and shoots it with Lubezki, it looks like an alien world. But like, I have walked those streets and I have been in those mosh pits, and it's just weird to see and weird to look at. And it's got fucking, oh God, what's his name? It's got Val Kilmer cutting his hair off and like taking a chainsaw to a thing. I mean,
for
you
like
give me
15
that.
15 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah. You give me that. You get number one film of the year. If Call Me By Your Name had Val Kilmer show up just to like put an axe through something, I would have immediately been like, oh shit, new number one.
Bren, I you know, and Song to Song is, I think, as I talked about on the podcast, this is the first Malick film I really just genuinely didn't like. And I have still kind of failed to understand why that is. So I'm just curious, like, whether you have any thoughts on, you know, division.
Because you're dead inside. I don't know.
No, I'm just curious whether, why you think this is the one that broke a lot of longtime Malick fans.
I think that people just aren't happy with what he's doing now. I think when you think of Terrence Malick, you think of Days of Heaven, Badlands, Thin Red Line, New World, and Tree of Life. And all those are very much the same type of film. And so he's just made such a dramatic shift that I think people are having a hard time really, really facing up to it. He's a little louder. He's a little crazier. He's a little dirtier. He's a whole lot sexier. And I'm talking about both him as a man and his movies.
I think there's nothing sexy about this movie, but okay. All right. I see what you're saying about the modern life thing, especially.
Yeah. I mean, it's easier to take. I think this is the funny thing, is that it's easier to take his kind of meandering, you know, whispery voiceover when it's taking place in the past, because that's how we like to think about our past. And I think him applying that same sheen to the modern world makes people uncomfortable, because I think they don't think the modern world deserves it.
But that's kind of interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the beauty of Terrence Malick, is that he can have, you know, unnamed Pocahontas and John Smith and everyone asking these questions in the New World, and then have very similar kind of conversations in something like To the Wonder or Knight of Cups. And but people, I think, aren't okay with that. I think that modernity invites a necessity for cynicism. And I don't think that he's giving that to people.
I think the one thing I will say I really do like about modern Malick is that he can make almost any space sacred.
Yeah.
Like that's one thing that I especially thought about in relation to Knight of Cups, in relation to like its narcissism and celebrity and the way that, you know, it treated, you know, prostitution. An escort, and you know, like him on a set with the same level of like grandeur and like holiness, I guess. Like that is one thing I do find it interesting. And I genuinely hope I like the next Malick film a lot more. I mean, I'm kind of glad that he's getting away from Lubezki for at least one film. But you know, that's just personal preference, honestly.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Shit, I can't remember. Oh, I am vaguely like weirded out. Like Malick is very good at making everything seem spontaneous. Even when his characters are like spinning in a cornfield, it still feels very spontaneous. And it sure makes some of the scenes in Knight of Cups and
To the Wonder?
Knight of Cups and Song to Song very uncomfortable, because I'm like, there's a point in Song to Song, like, where this woman has this wrenching monologue about, like, how she's a prostitute now because, like, her husband passed. And I was just like, is she really, like, is that her? Like, is this woman explaining her life? Like, it feels so real and so unrehearsed and so candid that it's either a fantastic performance or, like, Terrence Malick just like dialed up a hooker and was like, can you come in and like maybe we could like talk to you after some stuff? And she was just like, whatever, yeah. And there's a bunch of stuff like that. There's an old woman in this film who's a beggar, and it's just like, is that really a woman who was begging on the street while Emmanuel Lubezki was just kind of like wandering around with his camera? And I just don't know.
So it feels at once so artificial, but also like almost like voyeuristic, like documentary.
It doesn't ever feel artificial, actually. That's kind of the problem. Like if I could feel an artificiality, I might get some space from it, but it's so uncomfortably real. And I think that that's the type of thing that helps me to buy, you know, three of the most famous people on earth playing these like regular scale characters. And this is the second film that has Rooney Mara in it, I'm just realizing.
Wow, yeah. Brian, you convinced me to watch it again.
Good. I'm glad. You'll have to let me know how it goes. And you'll have to do it either right before or right after watching World of Tomorrow episode 2.
But Paddington 2 first.
Yes, obviously.
Always Paddington 2.
Paddington 2. And
gotta get that marmalade.
Nothing of the things that you people liked that I didn't see already, because I don't respect your parents. That's
not
all.
A surprise.
That's all for today. We've taken up enough of your time, and we're sorry. And We hope you enjoyed
this. Do we quickly want to run through our honorable mentions or just say fuck it all? Oh my god,
fine. You have 5 seconds to get through as many of your honorable mentions as you can, Bill. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, go.
Florida Project, Dunkirk, Thor Ragnarok, Call Me By Your Name, Good Time.
All right, excellent. Michael Snydell.
Florida Project, A Quiet Passion, Columbus, BPM, The Devil's Candy, The Work, and Personal Shopper.
All right.
Oh, Devil's Candy. And I need to see that.
Mine are, mine are Blade Runner 2049, Get Out, Nocturama, It Comes at Night, Through Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and then Coco.
Yeah, Coco.
Oh, you guys didn't have 3 billboards.
No.
No.
All right.
It was good.
It's a good movie. It's not top 10. You know what I'm saying?
Nope. Not even top 15, bro.
It's not as good as Brawl and Cell Block 99. That's for fucking damn sure.
We agree.
I feel like it is interesting because like we argued so vehemently that it was a good movie, and then like top 10s come around, and it's like, well, if it's not on your top 10, why did you argue so hard? And the answer to that question, as always, is because Michael Snydell was wrong.
As always. I love you guys too.
Yeah. All right. So that's it for today. Remember to go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow and give us your money. And also check us out. Check out Mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial for Mubi. They are currently giving their Sundance Selects series, so you can see awesome movies that premiered at Sundance. On the subject of Sundance, don't forget to listen to the other episodes dropping around the same time as this one, where I interview DJ Mecca and Jordan Raup about their time at Sundance Film Festival. Back to Mubi, though. If you'd like a free 30-day trial of Mubi, the best streaming service online, go to mubi.com/filmstage. All right, gentlemen. The time has come for us to say goodbye. Let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and the next time. Bill Graham.
You can find me in a theater watching Paddington 2 shortly after this podcast at CableBFG on Twitter, and also on the Patreon website. No, not the Patreon website. The Patreon supported Slack channel on Slack. brilliant. I'm out of words. Goodbye.
Yeah, we've
folks.
Been talking for like close to 2.5 hours. It's a shock that any of us
stupid.
Are still going.
Yeah. You could find me on Twitter at Snydell, Letterboxd at Snydell, on the Slack channel. And if you want longer thoughts about anything I talked about today, I put up a top 10 list on the Filmstage website.
All right, and you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, my Letterboxd also at Brian J. Rowan, and that's it. You can find my writing at thefilmstage.com, my personal site, dearfilm.net. That is all for this week. Next week we'll be reviewing something, certainly, but don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Our review of Paris, Texas will be coming at some point. Hopefully, no, it's not going to be before the end of January. That is in 2 days.
Yeah.
But it'll be very soon, and we will also be putting up another poll for what our next classic review will be on Twitter at Film Stage Show, so check that out. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and tune in next time.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever know.